Well, thank you for joining me. You might want to pull up a chair. I figured out what was going on. When my computer is running low, what it does is it starts to buffer me. So what that means is I start talking really fast. So what I'm going to do today is, I'm going to be recording that last part again with some added comments. The main point here is this: the United States lured the Middle East into trusting them. So when they decided to kick out the Europeans, they felt like they could be safe with the USA there, right? Well, that is psychopath maneuver 101. So let me get going here. They did announce that Apple is now going to be doing transcripts of podcasts. Does that mean you'll be able to understand what I'm saying and all that? Well, I doubt it. The deal is this, is that you cannot get clickable links on Apple. I don't know if you ever will be able to. And I provide you with a lot of links to go look for yourself because I don't tell you every single word and every single link. So, if you want clickable links, then stop listening on Apple. Pretty simple solution. Go to Spotify or go to my website. All the links there are, in fact, clickable. Make life easy on yourself. So, before I get started today, let me see here. The United States is contemplating the deployment of additional military advisors to the embassy in Kyiv as Russia appears to be gaining momentum on the front lines. First, they send in the advisors, then they send in a few troops, and then they've got full-out war. But of course, they don't call it war. The U.S. has not declared war since World War II. So these advisors would not serve in combat capabilities, but instead provide guidance and assistance to the Ukraine government and military, according to Pentagon spokespersons. Well, that's handy because the House just passed a $95 billion package of foreign aid for Ukraine, Israel, and other U.S. allies. But you'll notice it did not say other money for U.S. citizens, those people that are now sleeping on the streets here. Yeah, $95 billion of your tax dollars is being sent offshore once again. Congressional leaders pushed aside opposition from hard right conservatives to complete the bill in a rare Saturday session. With an overwhelming vote, the $61 billion in aid for Ukraine passed in a matter of minutes, a strong showing as American lawmakers raced to deliver a fresh round of U.S. support to the war-torn ally. Many Democrats cheered on the White House floor. Yay, yay, yay. Money for us, money for us. Oh, wait a minute. They didn't quite say that. Okay. They cheered and they waved blue and yellow flags of Ukraine. Biden, in a statement, thanked that Weasel Johnson, the transgender. Look, check out his wife. Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries and the bipartisan coalition of lawmakers who voted to put our national security first. What's wrong with our national security? I don't notice Russia invading us. I urge the Senate to quickly send this package to my desk so that I can sign it into law and we can quickly send weapons and equipment to Ukraine to meet their urgent battlefield needs, the president said. President Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine said he was grateful. Have you ever heard that guy talk? He was grateful to both parties in the House and personally, Speaker Mike Johnson, for the decision that keeps history on the right track. He said on X, formerly Twitter, "Thank you, America, and death to America," he said. No, I made up that last part. He said, "Thank you, America." Yeah, I'd say thanks too if you handed me billions of dollars. The scene in Congress was a striking display of action after months of dysfunction and stalemate, fueled by Republicans who hold the majority but are deeply split over foreign aid, particularly for Ukraine. Johnson relied on Democrats to ensure the military and humanitarian funding, the first major package for Ukraine since December 22, one approval. We have a responsibility, not as Democrats or Republicans, but as Americans, damn it, to defend democracy wherever it is risked. Democracy is at risk all over the world. We must defend it. We have the responsibility. What a load of crap. Okay. So before you're taking all that in and realizing that, hey, wait a minute, people here who actually paid into all this money are sleeping on the streets. How'd that happen? Well, quite simply, Washington, D.C. has its own flag and its own independent constitution. The Act of 1871 passed by Congress. Everybody in Congress likely knows they're there to deceive, okay? So in 1871, Congress passed a separate corporation known as the United States and corporate government for the District of Columbia. Thus, D.C. acts as a corporation through the act. The flag of Washington's District of Columbia has three red stars. The three stars denote D.C., Vatican City, and the City of London. A look at the various treaties raises the question of whether the U.S. remains a part of the British Crown Colony. The basis of this goes back to the first charter of Virginia, which in 1606 granted Britain the right to colonize America. It also gave the British king / queen sovereign authority over colonized America and its citizens. Colonized America was created after stealing America from the natives, well, either the people from India, the black people, whoever, right? If America was colonized with British subjects, then these people are subjects of the British government. Top of the hat, my fellow British people. The fate of every British person is now screaming, no, no, we're not related to those lousy Americans. Oh, yes, you are. Oh, yes, you are. To negate this was the Treaty of 1783, declaring independence from Great Britain. However, this treaty identifies the king / queen of England as the prince of the United States. Why do you think they call them the first ladies? Nevertheless, according to Bouvier's Law Dictionary, in monarchical governments, a subject owns permanent allegiance to the monarch, in which case the British subjects in colonized America owed permanent allegiance to the monarch. The reverse is applicable under constitutional law, where allegiance is owed to the sovereign and to the laws of a sovereign government, and natives are both subjects and citizens. But this was all changed. In 1933, every U.S. citizen was classified as enemies of the state. This is how the United States was stolen. This is how they have bypassed our Constitution and are able to illegally surrender American sovereignty to the United Nations. In 1933, the federal United States hypothecated all of the present and future properties, assets, and labor of their subjects. The 14th Amendment, the U.S. citizen, this all got forfeited and turned over to the Federal Reserve System. Since March the 9th, 1933, the United States has been in a state of declared national emergency. Under the powers delegated by these statutes, the president may seize property, organize and control the means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, institute martial law, seize and control all transportation and communication, regulate the operation of private enterprise, restrict travel, and control the lives of all American citizens. And this is from Senate Report 93-549. This situation has continued absolutely uninterrupted since March the 9th, 1933. We have been in a state of declared national emergency for nearly 85 years or so without knowing it. According to current laws, as found in 12 U.S.C. Section 95, everything the President or the Secretary of the Treasury has done since March the 4th, 1933, is automatically approved. And you're saying to yourself, well, wait a minute. We have rules. We have laws. This stuff has to go through Congress. Well, I'll keep reading for you. And you can find all of this also on my website. Go to the section called Timeline and learn to use that Control F or Control Find button. Look up birth certificate. You will find that your birth certificate is part of the debt of the United States. We are all, in fact, slaves to the system. Whether you want to admit it or not, it is indeed a fact. So go over there and look. You'll see exactly, and you can look on your own birth certificate, how they enslaved us. On March the 4th, so this happened on March the 9th, okay? 5 days before that, on March the 4th, 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt was inaugurated as president. 5 days later, on March the 9th, Congress approved in a special session his proclamation 2038 that became known as the Act of March the 9th, 1933. Be it enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the Congress hereby declares that a serious national emergency exists and that it is imperatively necessary speedily to put into effect remedies of uniform national application. This rule, and pay attention to this, because they're always talking, well, in the Constitution it says this, and all their people are always yapping about the Constitution, right? This rule was invoked to remove the authority of the Constitution. So whenever they're talking about, well, the Constitution says this, well, the Constitution does not matter because this act of March the 9th, 1933, negated the Constitution rubbish, okay? So while that was going on, the U.S. was over there in this involvement with the scramble for Africa. That was the invasion, colonization, and partition of most of Africa among seven Western Europeans. And that era, it's important to know, was called the New Imperialism. That ran from 1833 to 1914. So I don't know what this means because the U.S. was in there changing things around and they were actually a bankrupt corporation. So how does this apply to all these treaties? Well, it would take some legal mind to try to sort this out. I can only tell you what I know. So, and that figure, in 1870, they only had 10% of the African continent under European control. By 1914, so we're coming up close to World War I, right? By 1914, this figure had risen to almost 90%, with Liberia and Ethiopia retaining their full sovereignty. So, what happened? Well, there was also a secret enclave during the war among the Allies. So, first of all, there was the Constantinople Agreement on March the 18th, 1915, and that granted Russia Istanbul and control over the Dardanelles. So, what happened was it granted Britain and France vast other spheres over the Arab patrimony of the Ottoman Empire. So all around this time, they're starting to move in. You notice before World War I, right? So then the second one was the Treaty of London, which was signed April 26, 1915. And that may be characterized fairly as the Allied bribe to Italy to join the war and promised the Italians specific real estate benefits as Ottoman at Ottoman expense. So they're over there trying to put things in line, right? And the third thing was the Sykes-Picot. So two other things happened before Sykes-Picot. And the Sykes-Picot came more than a year later on May 1916, well after the basic deal had been agreed to among the Allied and signed. So see, they already signed the deal, they already agreed. But this one was required for several reasons. Over ambiguities in the original plan, evolving battlefield realities, and the fact that Britain had since opened and developed another channel of secret negotiations, this one with Sharif Hussein of Mecca, in now the famous Hussein McMahon correspondence. And I will have links. What I'm going to be doing is, once the show uploads today, give me about an hour before you look for the links. And what I'll do is I will, I lost the links for the last show, so I will figure them out. So give me an hour after you listen to the show and you'll find all the links, okay? Because this Hussein McMahon correspondence is critical. It shows that they were in there plotting ahead of time because the Sykes-Picot came with a map colored in five parts, direct and indirect British and French zones, and an international zone encompassing Jerusalem and a route westward to the coast of Haifa. So the indirect British and French spheres of influence were to be the domain of an independent Arab state. And those very words appear on the original map. So the fourth came in April of 1917, which widened the Italian take, but was contiguous on Russian acceptance. This acceptance never came due to the Russian Revolution. In fact, none of the prospective borders of any of these agreements, separately or taken together, ever came to pass. The Russian Revolution rendered moot the Constantinople Agreement, and the progress of General Edmund Allenby's armies in 1917 rendered much of the Sykes-Picot map moot as well. So they figured this map out and stuff, but then they said, well, this isn't exactly right. So then the Balfour Declaration on November 1917, which came with no map whatsoever, and the entry of the Zionist executive as a political element in the post-war decision-making process, further complicated matters regarding the border between the prospective British mandate for Palestine and the French mandate for Syria. After Versailles in 1919, a major conference was convened at San Remo, REMO, in April 1920 to nail down the borders once and for all, in anticipation of the deposit of the mandates with the League of Nations. But even the San Remo did not dissolve things finally. So what happened along this way was that, of course, they came up with a League of Nations. Oh no, we don't have anything to do with this. Let's get in another party and we'll call them the League of Nations and they can take responsibility. The Treaty of Sevres, signed in August 1920, imposed a very draconian settlement on the Ottoman Empire, but it is worth noting, did not insist on the end of the empire as such, or its possession of the Caliphate of Islam. So there's a lot of shaky deals going on here. It's not quite as clear as they have presented it. In any event, soon the Venezuelan government of Greece took advantage of Turkey's weakness to invade Anatolia with British support. This was a fateful and very stupid decision. It had the effect, along with other sources, of greatly strengthening and focusing the Turkish War of Liberation from a multi-sided encroachment on core Anatolia Turkish lands. Before it ended, about 18 months later, Turkish arms had crushed the Greeks. This outcome, in conjunction with the revived idea of an independent Armenian state, keep that in mind. So this came with a revived idea. So they were already thinking about an independent Armenian state. And that turn surveys, along with what little remained of the Sykes-Picot map, into a dead letter. None of the borders laid out at San Remo concerning the borders of the mandates with Turkey now made any sense. So they started signing all these treaties, and it was the Treaty of Lausanne, signed in 1923, which determined the borders between Turkey and the mandates for Syria and Iraq. No mandate for Armenia ever came into exist. However, as Turkey and the young Soviet Union jointly invaded the infant Armenian state and annihilated its independence, with the USSR putting an end around that time to all three of the newly sovereign Caucasus republics that had moved away from Moscow during the Russian Civil War of 1920-21. So, yeah, they're really... that whole region becomes just kind of a mixed match. So I can't tell you the complete story. I'm going to give you the links to look for yourself, because this literally, I could write this into a multi-volume of books, okay? So I'm just trying to pull out the key details which confirm the collusion and how this all got started, because it was, in fact, stolen, right? Winston Churchill created the Hashemite Emirate of Transjordan one Sunday morning in 1921 in Jerusalem over cigars and brandy, in conditions also far too complicated to summarize here. Note that this case borders were created for an entity that no one in his wildest imaginations ever conceived as existing in May. An 1888 Berlin conference had divided up sub-Sahara Africa. Thereafter, competitions moved in part to the South Pacific. By 1914, there was little lucrative real estate left on the planet, save what the Ottomans possessed and could be taken as a result of war. The two declarations may have a common origin. The secret Sykes-Picot Agreement, signed on May the 16th, 1916, in the same context of the First World War as the Balfour Declaration. From a French point of view, the link is crystal clear. While it was Jules Cambon who made a declaration similar to the Balfour Declaration, it was his younger brother, Paul Cambon, who assisted Picot during the negotiations with Sykes, and their project was colonial in nature, not Zionist. We know the English version of the Balfour Declaration. It was meant, and this is the part that it really gets wild, and I don't really have much of a clue why all this happened, but just listen along here. There's something here, but it was meant, so this, the English version of the Balfour Declaration, it was meant to thank the chemist Chaim Weizmann. The first name is Chaim, C-H-A-I-M, Weizmann, W-E-I-Z-M-A-N-N, who would later be the first president of Israel, for a crucial discovery he made for the Royal Navy. According to Wikipedia, While serving as a lecturer in Manchester, Wiseman became known for discovering how to use bacterial fermentation to produce large quantities of acetone. Acetone was used in the manufacture of cordite explosive, CORDIT explosive propellants critical to the Allied war effort. Winston Churchill became aware of the possible use of Wiseman's discovery in early 1915, and David Lloyd George, as Minister of Munitions, joined Churchill in encouraging Wiseman's development of the process. The importance of Wiseman's work gave him favor in the eyes of the British government. This allowed Wiseman to have access to senior cabinet members and utilize this time to represent Zionist aspirations. See, here's what I think they're doing. I think that they've written the Bible, they've written all these movies, they got all these books going, right? I think that even though, well, let me put it this way. Not many people are aware of what I've been talking about, right? About this incest thing, about how they came from a base group of 350 and how, you know, they really didn't come from Israel. Well, not many people are aware of that angle, right? And I've done shows about all this. And they do, in fact, come from incest, okay? And they did not, in fact, come from Israel. Those facts are clear. But what I think is happening is they're just continuing on like the script is true, right? Like maybe when they wrote the script, they figured no one would figure out that they really weren't from Israel, right? So, but they seem to be proceeding along like the script, right? Because now they're sneaking around and building bases over in Israel for all of them to, you know, group together to do more fighting over in that region. So, as usual, things are full of lies and deception, right? But I believe that they're going to be carrying out this plot that they came up with according to the Bible and their history books. So I'll keep reading here because this is very curious. So this gave him, Wiseman, access to senior cabinet members, okay? One of these senior members was none other than Sir Arthur Balfour, who took over Churchill as the First Lord, which is the head of the Royal Navy, and as such, equally aware of the importance of the Wiseman contribution to the fleet. So, why should the United Kingdom care about the fate of Palestine while engaged in a struggle with its survival at stake? The Balfour Declaration was a result of bargaining between Great Britain and American Jews, and later pledged to make use of their influence on the U.S. government and public to push them into war in exchange for Palestine. So they refer to this speech. They say that the Balfour Declaration was the result of bargaining between Great Britain and the American Jews. And what this thing said was, this is their quote, "When Germany was winning the war, the Jews, or maybe the Jesuits, were very happy because they didn't want Russia to come out the winner with France and England, because they thought it would be tougher for the Jews in Russia. So they were all pro-German. What happened? When the Germans trotted out the submarines, General Haig in London warned the English, 'We have less than 2 weeks' food supply for the whole nation.' So England was offered a peace treaty by Germany. It was on the desk of the British War Cabinet, ready to be signed. What happened? The Jews in New York, Washington, led by Brandeis, made this promise to Fleischmann and Sokoloff in London. They went to the British War Cabinet and they said, You do not have to make peace, which is tantamount to surrender. We can show you how to win the war. If when you defeat Germany and carve up Ottoman Empire or Turkey, you will give us Palestine. This version is not flawless since it doesn't fit the chronology of events. The Balfour Declaration is dated on November 2, 1917. However, by this date, the transfer of American troops to Europe was already well underway. The declaration of war by the United States on Germany itself, dating back to April the 6th. So the actual date of declaring war from the United States on Germany was actually April the 6th. But the Balfour Declaration is 5 or 6 months later in November the 2nd, 1917. Of course, we could just say that we shouldn't worry about getting an exact chronology. It is enough to say that by the end of 1917, England had other fish to fry, and that this Balfour Declaration doesn't make sense except for the bargain Friedman was hinting at. But now we have better than that now, the French Jewish version. On June the 4th, 1917, Jules Cambon, General Secretary, published an open letter to the representative of the World Zionist Organization in France. And he said, "You were good enough to present the project to which you are devoting your efforts, which has had its object the development of Jewish colonization in Palestine. You consider that, circumstances permitting, and the independence of the holy place being safeguarded, on the other hand, it would be a deed of justice and reparation to assist, by the protection of the Allied powers, in the renaissance of the Jewish nationality in that land from which the people of Israel were exiled so many centuries ago. There was no consideration for the people who lived in these countries, their well-being, or just consideration. It was just consideration for the resources that the countries themselves could benefit from. Instead of the conquering nations who claimed everything of value for themselves, these arbitrary and greedy decisions have led to a continuing series of oil wars." So they also allowed this person named Edwin Pauley to divide the oil resources between his friends who were warlord bankers and oil barons, assuring that Pauley himself got his profits. It was the negligence of Pauley's mentor, Charles Dawes, D-A-W-E-S, that allowed the tenets of the secret Sykes-Picot Treaty of 1916 and this other treaty of 1918 to go unchallenged because Woodrow Wilson could not get the Treaty of Versailles, the 14 points or the League of Nations ratified by the Versailles peace talks or the U.S. Congress. So the holdup was getting the League of Nations going, right? Pauley learned from Charles Dawes how to starve and control a defeated nation and fleece its assets. He learned from his close friend, Alan Dulles, who started the OSS, Office of Special Services, which became the CIA, how to confiscate the spoils of war and turn them into CIA fronts that launder confiscated gold, currency, assets, and oil into the open market. Edwin Pauley made sure that the CIA had control of the U.S. Treasury's Exchange Stabilization Fund so that it could control the laundered spoils and ensure that currency wars would be controlled by the CIA. The negotiations leading to the agreement occurred between November 1915 and March 1916, and it was signed 16 May 1916. The deal exposed to the public, let me see here, on November 1917 and in the British Guardian, November 17, is still mentioned when considering the region. So, yeah, what we're looking for is this. This is called New Imperialism, was when they went into Africa, okay? And it's important to know these words. So, New Imperialism characterizes a period of colonial expansion by European powers, the U.S. and Japan, during the late 19th and 20th centuries. This period featured an unprecedented pursuit of overseas territorial acquisitions. At the time, states focused on building their empires with new technological advances and developments, expanding their territory through conquest, and exploiting the resources of the subjugated countries. During the era of new imperialism, the European powers and Japan individually conquered almost all of Africa and parts of Asia. The new wave of imperialism reflected ongoing rivalries among the great powers, the economic desire for new resources and markets, and a civilizing mission ethos. Most of the colonies established during this era included gained independence from the era of decolonization. So what happened was they had an era after this one, which was called decolonization, and that followed World War II. The qualifier new is used to differentiate modern imperialism from earlier imperial activity, such as the formation of ancient empires and the first wave of European colonization. So what we're looking for is this new imperialism, okay? And so new imperialism was when they were grabbing up Africa, okay? So then I went looking for, well, what followed that one? The era that followed new imperialism is often referred to as the era of decolonization. This period began after World War I and continued through the 20th century. During this time, many of the colonies established during the new imperialism gained independence. And I think what happened was this. They say they gained independence, let's say, in Africa, right? But that was the era that they brought in all of those crazy African rulers, right? That was the era of Mandela, Castro, all those people came in around the same era. And they were, of course, all CIA agents, transgender, and all that stuff. So that was that process. But I want to tell you a little bit more about what went on in Belgium, because Belgium pretty much kind of laid the tracks for all the rest of these takeovers, okay? Until 1876, Belgium had no colonial presence in Africa. It was then that its king, Leopold II, created the International African Society. Operating under the pretense of an international scientific and philanthropic association, it was actually a private holding company owned by Leopold. Henry Morton Stanley was employed to explore and colonize the Congo River Basin area of Equatorial Africa in order to capitalize on the plentiful resources such as ivory, rubber, diamonds, and metals. Up until this point, Africa was known as the Dark Continent because of the difficulties Europeans had with exploration. Over the next few years, Stanley, who was hired by Leopold, overpowered and made treaties with over 450 native tribes, including over 500,000 square miles of land, nearly 67 times the size of Belgium. Neither the Belgian government nor the Belgian people had any interest in imperialism at the time, and the land came to be personally owned by King Leopold II. At the British Berlin Conference in 1884, he was allowed to have land named the Congo Free State. The other European countries at the conference allowed this to happen on the conditions that he suppress the East African slave trade, promote humanitarian policies, guarantee free trade, and encourage missions to Christianize the people of the Congo. However, Leopold's primary focus was to make a large profit on the natural resources, particularly ivory and rubber. In order to make this profit, he passed several cruel decrees that can be considered to be genocide. He forced the natives to supply him with rubber and ivory without any sort of payment in return. Their wives and children were held hostage until the workers returned with enough rubber or ivory to fill their quota. And if not, they could not get their families, or their families would be killed. When villages refused, they were burned down. The children of the village were murdered, and the men had their hands cut off. These policies led to uprising, but they were feeble compared to European military and technology might, and were consequently crushed. The forced labor was opposed in other ways. They fled into the forest to seek refuge, or they set the rubber forests on fire, preventing the Europeans from harvesting the rubber. No population figures exist from before or after the period, but it is estimated that as many as 10 million people died from violence, famine, and disease. However, some sources point to a total population of 16 million were wiped out. King Leopold profited from the enterprise with a 700% profit ratio for the rubber he took from Congo and exported. He used propaganda to keep other European nations at bay, for he broke almost all of the parts of the agreement he made at the Berlin Conference. What he basically did was he set up this deal, and he made these people into like a circus act, and he toured around Belgium with these native pygmies, to convince people that he was there doing good things. So, yeah, that's how that all happened. So now let's talk about these Circassians, okay? They're also people that are fleeing, right? So Circassians were people who fled from Russians, okay? So a Russian officer who witnessed this scene, the biggest scene at Kabab, it's Q-B-A-A-D-A, in May of 1864. Here, they're over there in May of 1864, okay? As other Russians were celebrating their victory, this Russian officer remarked, "On the road, our eyes were met with a staggering image, corpses of women, children, elderly persons, torn to pieces and half eaten by dogs, deportees emaciated by hunger and disease, almost too weak to move their legs, collapsing from exhaustion and becoming prey to dogs while still alive." Imperial Russia claims that over 400,000 Circassians were killed and 497,000 were forced to flee abroad to Turkey. Only 80,000 were left alive in their native land, but modern-day scholars put the figure at around 600,000 people who lost their lives to massacre, starvation, and the elements, while hundreds of thousands more were forced to leave their homeland. By 1867, three-fourths of the population was annihilated, and the Circassians had become one of the first stateless peoples in modern history. Most of the refugees fled to the Ottoman Empire, which welcomed the Circassians and resettled them across the empire. So what had happened was there had been a big fight, and the Circassians took their last stand. They took their last stand in Sochi, Russia, S-O-C-H-I. And here is a quote. In a canyon near Sochi, called Quebec locally, the Circassian forces and some of their allies made their last stand against the Russian army in May 1864. The place was renamed Krasnaya Polyana, meaning Red Meadow in Russian, for all the blood that had been spilt there. When it was later resettled by ethnic Russians in 1869. After the final battle in 1864, hordes of Circassians were driven to Sochi, where thousands of them died as they awaited deportation. Kind of like how they're herding people around over in Gaza, right? Herd them over to get some food, kill them while they're getting the food. So evidently, all these Circassians got driven into Sochi. And then in Sochi, a lot of them were slaughtered. So let me scroll down here for a minute. So this part of it gets to be crazy complicated, okay? And I'm not going to be going through it all because for example, before the 1880s, they had Kurdish tribes were actually a much greater military threat to the civil order of the Ottoman Empire than were the Armenian rebels. So why did they wipe out all the Armenians? So I'm going to be skipping along here because my point in all of this, not to lay out every battle these people had, but to point out who was involved and at what times, right? So here comes my next big question. Most Circassians settled in Turkey. Later, historians regarded them as having played a key role in the history of Turkey. Circassians took an active role in the Ottoman state in high positions from their arrival until the collapse of the empire. After the collapse of the empire, Circassians in Turkey became the target of blatant campaigns of discrimination. So I don't know what they say. People question, was the Circassian catastrophe a genocide? So evidently, the Circassians, once they landed in Turkey, they got into high positions. So why exactly is that? Why would that happen? And I found this article is that in the beginning, God made me Circassian. Circassians arrived in Amman, Jordan, over 150 years ago, fleeing genocide and war in the North Caucasus. In the final decades of Ottoman rule, several waves of refugees from the Russian Empire's North Caucasus regions immigrated to Transjordan, whereas they found Amman and other agricultural villages. So the Circassians, also known as Kirkis, are an indigenous Northwest Caucasus ethnic group and a nation native to the historic region of Circassia in the Northern Caucasus. As a consequence of the Circassian genocide perpetrated by the Russian Empire in the 19th century during the Russo-Circassian War, most Circassians were exiled from their homeland in Circassia to modern-day Turkey and the rest of the Middle East, where most of them are today. In the early 1990s, this group called the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organizations estimated that there are as many as 3.7 million Caucasians in over 50 countries. The 2014 Winter Olympic facilities in Sochi, which was once the Circassian capital. And why was that? So Sochi, where they had the Olympics, that was once the Circassian capital, was built in areas that were claimed to contain mass graves of Circassians who were killed during genocide by Russia in military campaigns lasting from 1860 to 1864. Because they had been fighting the Russians supposedly for years, right? And the final battle happened right there at Sochi. So they cemented over that area and they built the Olympics on top of it all. The year 2014 also marked the 150th anniversary of the Circassian genocide, which angered the Circassians around the world. Many protests were held all over the world to stop the Sochi Olympics, but were not successful. And then I was looking at, they say that they founded the place called Amman, right, over in Jordan. What's over in Amman? I found some quotes. Somebody said, this is their quote. They said, the seven villages. What else? They have seven villages on the seven hills. Washington, D.C. is also seven hills, right? All these things are seven hills. There's a lot of places with seven hills, but only some specifically make sense, okay? And these people are freaks for all this stuff. So let me read you this quote. The seven villages on these seven hills. I lived in Amman for a couple of years and have fond memories of the Agadine and the Circassians in general. The Sochi Olympics were a huge slap in the face of all Circassians. The very spot where hundreds of thousands of Circassians met their deaths. Not only did they host the Olympics literally on top of the graves of the dead, but is even a plaque there that commemorates the defeat of the evil Circassian bandits. Yep, the Russians killed off a huge number of people, deported a huge number of people, and stole a ton of land. You don't get to be the largest nation on earth by being nice. So they went on to say the Caucasians, Siberians, and East Asians took the brunt of it. So I don't know. So let me see here. Yeah, they also had this weird deal going in Circassia. I'm going to keep scrolling along here. The Circassians were also pagan. That's what I got. When I found out the Circassians were pagan early on, that's why I kept my eyes on them, right? It is worthwhile to mention that pagan songs, now completely out of use, give us clues as to the concept the ancient Circassians had of the creation and the world. These same songs were adapted twice in the Christian and Muslim eras and used to praise the new deities. A person smitten with lightning was thought to have been ordained by an angel for benediction, and a solemn ceremony was conducted in his honor. The parents overjoyed with the newfound status. The crowds would go outside listening to the clamor created by the aerial angel, as if no thunder was heard for some time. Prayers would have been said for its return. This is apparently a mirage of the ancient ceremony of adoration of a later Christian influx. Holidays and red-letter days on which religious ceremonies were held were usually fixed in the Circassian calendar. Each deity had a day, sometimes more, consecrated to his/her worship. So this is starting to sound more and more like the Jesuits, right? Because they would go clamoring outside for angels and stuff. They had the ancient pagan ceremonies. They had rites of devotion to specific deities. Adorable deities were represented mainly by effigies made from trees. In times of drought, a procession carrying an effigy of the goddess of rain marched through the stricken village with supplications for rain. Ancient Circassians venerated their ancestors, believing in the immortality of the soul. They buried the dead with full panoply of arms and other things near their sacred groves. Feasts were held annually at certain times in honor of the dead, who were represented with fairs in the belief that they maintained their bodily functions and were capable of feeling. Stemming from ancestral worship was the cult of the hero. Like in Greek religion, some humans of extraordinary abilities were elevated to the ranks of gods. Many of the gods probably started out as human beings. So, yeah, they were big into this god business. Some characters seem to have been stuck between humanity and godliness, having unusual faculties, but not really admitted into the pantheon. In this category, maybe include Satanae and Sorosway. Human and animal bones found in ancient burial grounds provide evidence of the ancestors of the Caesareans practiced sacrifice, which might have held a secret position in ancient proto-religious rites. According to legend, so yeah, all of this stuff, crops, all of this stuff had to do with these other theories, right? Oaths invoking a deity were performed in accordance with special rites. Oftentimes, they were taken at some wine-drinking festivals, since pledges made facing wine tons more binding. Contravention of an oath brought everlasting damnation, contempt, and shame, not to say retribution and punishment. In the language of Longworth, if customary law was tyrant, then the oath was the sole monarch to whom all people of the caucus submitted. His seal is that confers validity on every compact, social or political. He is the mighty arbiter of all differences, he concluded. In fact, he hinted that the sacredness with which the Circassians held their pledges contributed to some extent towards their downfall at the hands of the more worldly Russians. The expulsion of the Circassians, the Indian removal in the United States throughout history prior to the 20th century, there have been many attempts to exterminate nation or religious groups. Why is there still significant dispute as to whether these acts constitute ethnic cleansing or genocide? So this is why they always bring up these questions. Like now with what's going on in Israel, they still can't come to terms with, well, is it genocide? Well, I don't know. What do you think? Well, I don't know. According to history, maybe it's genocide. I don't know. Maybe it's not. So they have that same thing. Many historians support the notion of it being an act of genocide. Many still deny that it constituted genocide or even an act of ethnic cleansing. And this person went on to say, however, from what I have gathered in my reading, numerous Russian sources at the time argued for the total removal of the Caesareans from their ancestral homeland, either through deportation or outright extermination. And they have a quote here from Wikipedia. In 1857, Dmitry Miluti first published the idea of mass expulsions of Circassian natives. Matlin argued that the goal was not to simply move them so that their land could be settled by productive farmers, but rather that eliminating the Circassians was to be an end in itself, to cleanse the land of hostile elements. Tsar Alexander II endorsed the plan, and Mutlin later would become the Minister of War in 1861, and from the early 1860s, expulsions began occurring in the Caucasus. Though the Circassians were offered land north of the Kuban, this was poor quality and largely uninhabitable. And at least according to other sources I've read, and the validity of this offer seems to be in question anyway. The Circassians knew full well that the lowlands being offered to them were uninhabitable. If the Cossacks who were born in the Mismas or migrated there from the steppes fell ill in terrible numbers there, then what sort of effect would the Mysas have on the inhabitants of the mountains who had always breathed fresh, healthy air? In any event, this seems to me to be a clear-cut case, at the very least, ethnic cleansing. The ultimate goal was always the removal of the Circassians from Circassia, which is in line with the UN definition of ethnic cleansing. So, yeah, whatever it is, it's something, right? Claiming genocide or ethnic cleansing is an attempt by nefarious outside forces to destabilize the North Caucasus and promote separatism and strife within Russia. So, yeah, there is just a lot to where they kicked out, where they genocided. I think we're all going to have to just think for ourselves, right? Like I said, not going to solve this problem today, but what I'm saying is this. It's pretty suspicious that these people were roaming around, right? All of a sudden, the Russians just had to kick them out of that area. All of a sudden, they land in Turkey, and then a bunch of Armenians start getting slaughtered in Turkey. So they have that genocide going on over there. And, well, who's behind it all? Well, the only people that I found in this mess so far that are pagans are the Circassians, right? They share that lug of pagan. They also were the ones who landed over in Jordan, right? So then you throw in the Kurds. So there were attempts to create a Kurdish society as early as 1880s. The most concerned seemed not the Ottomans, but the British, who did not even have a foothold in the region. So, yeah, I would venture to say this. I think that a lot was going on around that time. I think the reason for World War I was to put all of this stuff in place. But the bottom line is this. The U.S. tricked this whole thing to get in charge of that region. That's why they always have that hidden hand, right? You always see a hand hidden in their vest jacket. They always work with a hidden hand. And remember what I said at the beginning of the last show. Everybody thinks it's a wolf that's out to get them, right? Really, it's a shepherd. Let's think about that one. They teach children to pray to the shepherd, right? I knew nothing about it, but I knew the word shepherd meant the church. So, yeah, so do I have any answers for you? Not really, but I have an interesting thing going on here. Let me get down to that. Because, yeah, then Constantinople was the center of the Circassian slave trade. Why were all those Circassians, we'll circle back here, why were they entering the slave trade? Well, maybe some Circassians were. But why were some of them running things, right? So they land, a lot of them get into high positions. So why exactly didn't they stop their fellow people from entering the slave trade, right? Brings up a big question. So from 1864 onward, white slave girls were no longer sold in the open slave market, but were sold directly in the residence of the slave trader. The Circassian girls were bought by the slave traders very young, were raised by the slave trader and his family as foster daughters to become ideal wives and sold via a marriage broker to the buyer for money in the residence of the slave trader. The hidden nature of the Circassian slave trade makes it invisible to foreign diplomats and expose it less to public criticism than the more open African slave trades. So why is it that the Circassians had their own special slave trade? The Circassian slave trade was considered a luxury trade. White women were sold for 6 times as much as the ethnic category that was regarded as second best, the women from Abyssinia, who were sold for between a tenth or a third of the price of a white woman, depending on how light her skin was. The preference of white girls over African girls as sex slaves was noted by the international press when the slave market was flooded by white girls in the 1850s due to the Circassian genocide, which resulted in the price for white slave girls to become cheaper, and Muslim men who were not able to buy white girls before now exchange their black slave women for white ones. The New York Daily Times reported on August 6, 1856, and this is their quote, "In former times, a good middling Circassian girl was thought very cheap at £100. But at the present moment, the same description of goods may be had for £5. Formerly, a Caesarian slave girl was pretty sure of being bought into a good family, where not only good treatment, but often rank and fortune awaited her. But at present low rates, she may be taken by any huckster who never thought of keeping a slave before. Another evil is that the temptation to possess a Circassian girl at such low prices is so great in the mind of the Turks that many who cannot afford to keep several slaves have been sending their blacks to market in order to make room for a newly purchased white girl. The consequence is that numbers of black women, after being as many as 8 or 10 years in the same hands, have lately been co-signed to the broker for disposal. Not a few of those wretched creatures are in a state quite unfit for being sold. I have it on authority of a respectable slave broker that at the present moment, there have been thrown on the market unusually large numbers of negresses in the family way, some of them even slaves of pashas and men of rank. He finds them so unsaleable that he has been obligated to decline receiving any more. A single observation will explain the reason of this, which might appear strange when compared with the value that is attached even to an unborn black baby in some slave countries. In Constantinople, it is evident that there is a very large number of negresses, like black women, living and having habitual intercourse with their Turkish masters. Yet it is a rare thing to see a mulatto. What becomes of the prodigy of such intercourse? I have no hesitation in saying that it is getting rid of by infanticide, and that there is hardly a family in Istanbul where infanticide is not practiced in such cases as a mere matter of course and without the least remorse or dread. So they just kill the babies. Any mulatto babies, they just kill them. White women slaves were primarily bought to become wives or concubines, which would be sex slaves for rich men. To buy a daughter-in-law was seen as a good alternative when arranging a marriage, since she was likely to become a humble wife, lacking her own money as well as relatives, and completely dependent upon her new family. Since white women were very expensive on the slave market, this essentially functioned as a marriage market for the upper class, and many of the consorts of the Ottoman and Egyptian rulers and other rich men were former victims of the Circassian slave trade, which made it a sensitive subject for Western diplomats to criticize. During the entire 19th century, many consorts of the Ottoman sultans were described as Circassian women who had been entrusted to the harem as children and brought up as foster daughters of the female family members of the Ottoman dynasty, and then presented to the Ottoman imperial harem, where they became consorts, a euphemism for slave concubines to the Ottoman sultans. The slave concubines in the harem in Iran were also Georgian and Armenian girls, some war captives, but also bought on the slave markets and presented as gifts to the Shah of Iran from other provinces. The Circassian slave trade was maintained in the early 20th century under the guise of a marriage market. The American journalist E. Alexander Powell described the slave trade of harems of North African Maghrebis in 1912 that when a rich Muslim man wished to enlarge his harem, he applies to one of the well-known dealers in Tripoli. A marriage contract is drawn up and all the ceremonies of legal wedlock are gone through by proxy. By resorting to these fictitious marriages and similar subterfuges, the owner of a harem may procure as many slaves, white, brown, or black, as he wishes, and once they are within the walls of his house, no one can possibly interfere to release them, for the police being under no conditions permitted to violate the privacy of a harem. There is obviously no safeguard for the liberty or even the lives of the inmates. As a result of this system, a constant stream of female slaves, fair-haired beauties from Russia and Circassia, brown-skinned Arab girls from the borders of the Sahara and Negresses from Ecuador trickles into the North African coast towns by various roundabout channels. And though the European officials were perfectly aware of this condition of things, they are powerless to end it. The women thus attained, though nominally wives, are in reality slaves, for they are bought for money. They are not consulted about their sale. They cannot go away if they are discontented, and their very lives are at the disposal of their masters. If this is not slavery, I don't know what is. However, the Circassian slave trade did not exclusively trade in female slaves. During the Qajar dynasty of Iran, slave soldiers, or gilmen, were still used for the royal guard, and they were mainly white slaves from Caucasus. The 1828 war with Russia put an end to the import of white slaves from the Russian Empire borderlands as it undermined the trade in Circassian and Georgians, which caused the end of slave trade in Iran, when free Iranians were employed by the Royal Guard instead of the still available African slaves. Girls from the Caucasus and the Circassian colonies in Anatolia were still trafficked to the Middle East in the 1920s. In 1924, the law prohibited the enslavement of white girls, normally Armenian or Georgian, on Kuwait territory. But in 1928, at least 60 white slave girls were discovered. It became more and more rare to find white girls in the slave trade from around the mid-19th century onward, and was gradually replaced by light-skinned women from both Africa and Asia, a slave trade that continued until the 1960s and 1970s, when slavery in Saudi Arabia, slavery in the UAE, and slavery in Oman was finally banned. So this stuff continued until the 1960s or 70s. According to a March 1886 article in the New York Times, the Ottoman Empire allowed a slave trade in girls to thrive during the late 1800s while publicly denying it. Girl sexual slaves sold in the Ottoman Empire were mainly of three ethnic groups: Circassian, Syrian, and Nubian. Circassian girls were described by the American journalists as both fair and light-skinned. They were frequently sent by Circassian leaders as gifts to the Ottomans. See, why is that, right? Why would Circassian leaders be sending white girls gifts to the Ottomans? They were the most expensive, the most popular with the Turks. The next most popular slaves were Syrian girls with dark eyes and hair and light brown skin. They were described by the American journalists as having good figures when young. Throughout coastal regions in Anatolia, Syrian girls were sold. The New York Times journalist stated Nubian girls were the cheapest and least popular. At Istanbul, the sale of black and Circassian women was conducted openly, even well past the granting of the Constitution in 1908. Throughout the 19th and 20th century, slavery gradually became outlawed and suppressed in Muslim lands due to a combination of pressures exerted by Western nations such as Britain and France, internal pressure from Islamic abolitionist movements, and economic pressure. So, why did some of them end up in power and some of them end up being sold as slaves? Big question, right? And then there's this aspect of this group called the Young Turks. The Young Turks supposedly, during the Ottoman Empire, the Circassians were rather privileged compared to their political status in the Turkish Republic. The modern Turkish, so up until then, they were great. And then they decided that the Circassians, after they started to accumulate economic power, people started to kind of turn against them. That's one pattern always to look for, right? But then what happens, right? They all seem like they're pretty friendly now. The international aspect of Circassian involvement to the Young Turk movement in the 19th century. Here's what I think happened. Supposedly, there was a group called the Young Turks, which I spoke about earlier. The Young Turks were a vicious group which annihilated a lot of people, right? Well, the Young Turks came to power. And I have this kind of crazy thing to show you. We have a show here in the United States on YouTube called The Young Turks. The Young Turks is a very, well, it's not popular. It's promoted by YouTube, okay? The Young Turks is a huge media show on YouTube. I think they have 5 or 6 or 8 million subscribers, okay? Big group. Well, one of their main commentators on the Young Turks is a person called Anna Kasparian. Anna Kasparian is a host on the Young Turks. Of course, she's also transgender. She is Armenian, and she is on the Young Turks. Supposedly, the Young Turks wiped out the Armenians in a genocide that went on about that time. And the genocide of the Young Turks, okay, let me explain this, because this shows, to me, this shows some collusion, but I don't know what. Like I said, I got a lot of questions, right? Why would a popular news group be called the Young Turks? Well, why would a Young Turks news group hire a woman whose parents were Armenians. Anna Kasparian is the daughter of Armenian immigrant parents, okay? And supposedly the Armenians were wiped out in a vicious genocide by the Young Turks. So she's the daughter. Her paternal great-grandparents experienced the Armenian genocide firsthand in 1915, because right around World War I, they were over there killing the Armenians. So how does a girl or woman who is the granddaughter, great-granddaughter of Armenian immigrants go to work seriously for a company called the Young Turks, who were in fact responsible for their own genocide? Doesn't make much sense, right? But if you take a look, they all connect there, right? Like Jimmy Dore, the so-called comedian, he was at the Young Turks for over 10 years. Of course, they all act like they hate each other now, right? And once Jimmy Dore left the Young Turks, he starts spilling things. He said that the Young Turks got over $20 million in Hollywood investment money. So, but it's all staged, because right before Jimmy Dore left the Young Turks, then supposedly they get in a big fight. But before he left the Young Turks, Jimmy Dore raised thousands of dollars. I can't remember, 50 or more thousand dollars to come up with his new studio. So the viewers of the Young Turks paid Jimmy Dore for his new studio. And now, of course, they're all fighting with each other and claiming they hate each other. And then along with the Young Turks, the guy that runs the Young Turk is a guy named Cenk Uygur, C-N-K Uygur, Y-U-G-E-R. Well, he was one time somebody with MSNBC, and now he runs the Young Turks, right? And he's hired Anna Kasparian. Well, what other baggage besides Jimmy Dore does Cenk have? Well, first of all, Jimmy Dore comes from an Irish cop family. Well, Jimmy Dore has been transgendered. I'm sure his so-called wife, Stephanie, is really his handler. That's a man in a wig. So he comes from an Irish cop family out of Chicago, okay? In one of his quotes, Jimmy Dore said he was talking about how much he loved his first manager. I think what sets this all up is they have business managers or talent managers, right? So Jimmy Dore, after being transgendered by his parents, his Irish cop family, gets a book deal. He says his manager got him like a $20,000 advance. He gets a book deal. He gets a job on the Young Turks. See how it all starting to work out. Then, during the middle of all this, Cenk Uygur has this nephew called Hasan Piker, P-I-K-E-R. Hasan Piker is the nephew of Cenk Uygur. Hasan Piker recently got into a big fight online with Anna Kasparian over being transgender. No, they were not admitting to being transgender. It was a big act. What happened was Anna Kasparian was saying, I am a woman. You're always going to call me a woman. Well, and Anna Kasparian is not a woman, okay? Hasan Piker is not a man, but they got this big public fight over being called a woman. So, where does Hasan Piker come from? Well, he comes from a very well-known Turkish very high-level Turkish family. And I've seen pictures of him. His parents were extraordinarily wealthy. And he was, you know, there's pictures of him on a very expensive horse as a young child. So his parents were extremely wealthy Turkish politicians, okay? Hasan Piker, related to the guy who runs the Young Turks thing, okay? Because Hasan's father is a person, Hemet Piker, a political scientist and economic. Very, very wealthy. Hasan belonged to a well-to-do family. So his family was in Turkey, very rich. They come over here, and then the kids are getting all these deals. Remember what I said, their children get the deals. So why would Hasan, his Uncle Cenk, and this Anna woman all be colluding together? Well, because they're part of the elites, right? But on the surface, it doesn't seem like it makes a lot of sense, because my mother was born in 1926, okay? Now, if my mother had been had her family wiped out in a horrible genocide, would I have taken a job with somebody who had been part of wiping out my mother's family? Well, I would say, of course not, right? But this is all intricately woven, okay? There's a lot of lies hooked into this that we don't know about, because what you have to do is eventually start connecting them by who they connect with, right? Because in the big wheel of things, they all connect with each other. So this leaves us with all these big questions, like, where did all those kids that were being sent around on all those trains, where did they all come from? Where did they all end up? Does anybody in this country really know who their own children are? And I've got something here that I'm going to be closing with, and it's pretty good. Let me get here. Okay. There was a House resolution. We've been talking about these Freemasons, right? And this 33 business. As a matter of fact, that secret base that's now going up in Palestine area, let me see here, the secret base is called 521. Well, 521 means 8, right? They love that number 8. When you take the number 8 and you divide it in half, you get 33. The number 8 splits in half to 33, okay? Anyone who doubts that Freemasons still control the U.S. government should read House Resolution 33, which passed in 2007, which states in part, recognizing the thousands of Freemasons in every state in the nation and honoring them for their many contributions to the nation throughout its history. Whereas Freemasons, whose long lineage extends back to before the nation's founding, have set an example of high moral standard and charity for all people. Keep in mind, everything's opposite, right? So, H. Resolution 33 was submitted by Congressman Paul Gilmore. So, they have these beliefs that I'd like to talk to you about now, just because it's a good place to talk about. Because I'll be back. There's a lot more to this whole story with this rosary and the baptism, all this stuff. But anyway, let me focus here. So, here's what they believe, okay? The elites, remember that EL comes from Saturn, right? The elites believe that they are a more advanced form of human. In order to justify their belief, they grafted Darwin's theories of biological evolution onto social organizations to create what's called social Darwinism, okay? Over the centuries, they have referred to the public variously as cattle, sheep, and its. They've always referred to us as those words, cattle, sheep, and its. And I have another show about the sheep part, but too complicated for here, so I'll talk about that next, okay? So, and remember, the vaccines came from the word vaca, which means cow, right? Vaca means cow in Spanish, and that's where the word vaccine comes from. So over the centuries, they have referred to the public as cattle, sheep, and its, or they refer to us as them or the working class, right? Social Darwinism is merely the modern expression of this attitude and their elitist belief system. Under this belief system, only those that have proven their worth over many generations of dominance and control are worthy of entrance into high elite circles. The elite throughout history, in support of belief in their own superiority over the common person, have practiced inbreeding amongst themselves. They do this to preserve intelligence, love of power, and above all, the ruthlessness and willingness to kill as required. They still practice this today. And I've talked about this in the past. That's why they create their own children to become psychopathic. But remember, they're not having their own children. So somebody else is having their children. And I'm just going to guess here. I think they probably have some sort of ritual to declare that child part of their bloodline. Because if you look at bloodline in general, we would assume it means because they came from these persons' blood, right? But that's not how it really works because they haven't been having their own children for a very long time. So what they're doing, and I've done shows about they're doing things to their kids to make them more psychopathic is the bottom line. Also, along similar lines, they believe in and practice of eugenics on the public to control the population and to make them more docile, controlled, stupid, and compliant. This is not a belief, but more of a sobering fact that must be considered when evaluating the values and actions of the elite, excuse me. It has well been established. So he did this book, and the elite and those that are the most capable of rising to the top of a system based on money are psychopathic. This includes leaders of all centers of power, of course, but remember, when you start looking at the leaders, also microcosm that, right? Because don't just look at the people that you see on your screen. Look at the people you see on your small screen, the people you see in your local communities and stuff too. Don't leave them out of this confusion because what happens is everybody gets confused and they start thinking, oh, it's just the elites. Well, the elites also have their little minions running all these towns and stuff, right? So this piece I found very interesting. So this is how they're coming up with this thing. As it's hard to imagine, the elite practice a form of pagan religion based on the mystery school religions of Sumer and Babylon, under which they seek to achieve godhood. Equally important is the use of religion to control the masses, and to that end, they create esoteric religions for the masses while embedding in those religions hidden meanings that only those and they that are enlightened can see. And that's why they call themselves the Illuminati. Consequently, the ancient symbols used thousands of years ago can still be seen in religion, business, and the media today. Well, I believe that they took over the game board a couple hundred years ago, and then they just rewrote the his story, right? And then there was this other theory that I'll keep talking about. The elite have long viewed a rising population as a threat to their dominance. They realize that eventually a large number of people will eventually overthrow and remove them from power. Excuse me. They are particularly concerned with the middle class, whose intelligence and capacity to organize makes them the biggest threat. Well, until you put smartphones in front of all those people, right? The elite, and this is where it gets interesting. And I've talked about in the past, I've talked about how they use predictive programming, movies and stuff to show us the future. And the one that I've talked about the most is, oh God, I can't even remember right now. Anyway, I'll keep moving. It's the one where we're all starving to death. But anyway, so the elites do tell us through their books and publications, movies and news releases what they're doing. This is called revelation of the method. If you are too stupid to recognize it for what it is, that is your problem from their point of view. It is a form of ritual mocking of the victim. You have been taken hostage by a series of narratives laid on with a shovel by the predator class and designed for the sole purpose of keeping you wrapped and not informed, sedentary and not spirited. In the worlds of algorithm everywhere, everyone is created equal, and data is just data. There's no morality to it. These events play out as a nail-biting whodunit, but the reality is they're not supposed to be solved. There's no answers, no restitution. It's your awareness and not your belief system which is being harvested. What these hellhounds want is for you to pick your side, choose your battle, but make sure your battle lines are social media and that you're not throwing Molotov cocktails at the power of Babel. everyone has a dog in the fight, particularly those baying for the blood of the unvaccinated or calling for violence against Russians who do so, according to Voltaire, because those who can make you believe in absurdities can make you commit atrocities. I'll repeat that. Those who make you believe in absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And just think for a minute about what happened in Rwanda, and I'll continue reading. A lot of people in Rwanda got caught up killing their own neighbors because of being directed by the psychopaths in charge. And I will continue reading. It's quite simple, really. If a person's psyche is under siege and they don't designate an enemy to scapegoat, they might get wise to who is really attacking them. And that simply won't do. In this theater of the absurd, people acclimate to fiction because it's easier than confronting uncomfortable truths. But under these fertile conditions, any version of reality, no matter how precarious, will wash. That's where the Great Reset enters the fray. Once you degrade a person's moralistic and cultural maps of the world, their place in it becomes increasingly untenable. People lose touch with reality and what it means to be human. The ensuing crisis of identity leaves them susceptible to hostile takeover. Among other things that could possibly go wrong is eventually brainwashing them into non-existence, predictive programming. But there are even stranger things brewing. Predictive programming is the theory of a hidden hand operating the levers of reality. A sort of reality adjustment of bureau, obfuscating real-world events through film, literature, and media manipulation. The fundamental process here is psychological conditioning that reduces people's resistance to the acceptance of planned future events and encourages them to swap concrete reality structures for static constructs until eventually our inherited worldview is replaced by mythos and archetypes. That we are living through the objectification of the predator class is no mute point. That's their messiah complex imprinted onto the collective consciousness and projected back onto the real world. By their own volition, the masses are breathing life into these grotesqueries and blotting the social fabric. Revelation of the method, but it runs deeper than predictive programming. Some call this revelation of the method. According to Michael Hoffman, first they suppress the counter-argument, and when the most opportune time arrives, they reveal aspects of what's really happened, but in a limited hangout sort of way. There is a war raging, all right, but you will find the theater of operations inside the human psyche. It is a war on the consciousness, an atrophy of culture, and its stark consequences in the spiritual malaise of humanity. Freemasons, for one, understood that information was power. Concealing beyond the prying eyes of the lower orders the esoteric mysteries of the universe. Then, as now, it's not enough for these people to hold a monopoly over knowledge. They must deprive everyone else of its illumination, or go one further and spread ignorance. It goes beyond censoring, counter-arguments to fomenting falsehood. It's not so much society breakdown, but self-emulation. People are being misinformed and stupefied and sent out as agents of disinformation to further deconstruct what's left of an already deconstructed reality. To make matters worse, precisely zero lessons have been learned from the past 2 years. People flounder from one crisis to the next, walked aimlessly from one quarantine camp to air raid shelter into whichever direction their political higher-up points them to deride whatever is nominal as the scourge of society du jour. The great national pastime is to gather at the pillories and hurl cabbages. If all this sounds remarkably like an info war, then it probably is. The battle for hearts and minds have moved online. Our divine spark of life is being overhauled to data. Something of divine proportion compels us to the internet, to data our daily bread and circuses, our daily avatars living richer, more meaningful lives than their truant owners. What ceases to be worth the candle is the paucity of our data. It doesn't matter which side of the fence you're on, a card-carrying member of the Great Awakening or a useful idiot on the same platform. You're still part of the same problem. You've been taken hostage by a series of narratives laid out with a shovel by the predator class and designed for the sole purpose of keeping you wrapped and not informed, sedentary and not spirited. So yes, everyone has a dog in the fight, particularly those baying for the blood of the unvaccinated. They got us to really, I think this whole thing, let me see here. I think I must have copied that 100 times. Let me see here. So we got the predictive. So this is about we are living through the objectification of the predator class is no mute point. That's their messiah complex imprinted onto the collective consciousness and projected back onto the real world. So yes, I believe that the masses are actually doing their bidding. The house is not designed to do its own housekeeping. Buried deep within their rule of law is a hidden constitution that states nothing happens without your consent. This is to pay very close attention to. In this version of contract law, once the truth is hidden in plain sight, you have agreed to it. There exists someplace an unsigned contract with your unsworn oath on it. In the end, we're all victims of the same master stroke, whether keyboard evangelist or state apologist. Everyone is being royally screwed. And it's not so much that they're laughing at you, is that you are laughing at yourself. Social engineering is a vast, even scientific phenomenon that humanity has been steered and manipulated and literally harvested for eons by self-serving controllers is a historical fact. So, yeah, we keep repeating the exact same things, right? I am going to be, what they say here is programming. Familiarizing the target audience with potential outcomes in a millennial that serves their purpose. One of fear and fatalistic acceptance. It's nothing but conditioning disguised as entertainment. The entire industry is controlled by the same manipulators, steering mankind by the nose in any direction they want. The sheer bombardment of mind-numbing genres of soul-polluting films and TV shows from vampires and slasher flicks, war and police glorification memes, to the end-of-the-world scenarios is beyond overwhelming. On top of this, the news media continually pump out assumptive information directing the audience toward their desired conclusions. The point is, we're being programmed for a desired future. Not one we desire, but they desire. The more blindly familiar people are with their intended result, the more quickly and easily it will be adopted. So I found something about the calendar, because I've been talking about, I think there's something about that quantum business, that they trick the calendar. And I'll read this. It says, as an example, take our calendar. Suppose the entire modern calendar is deliberately skewed and the elites themselves operate according to a secret calendar. We believe that the last century began in 1901 and ended on the last day of 2000. But the Mayan calendar ended in 2012, when nothing, or at least nothing obvious, seems to have happened. If this was the true last year of a century, the first year would be 1913, the Luciferian number of 13. And what happened in 1913? Our glorious President Woodrow Wilson gave us the income tax, the Federal Reserve, and the direct election of U.S. senators, which sounds very democratic, but undercuts state sovereignty. This set the stage for America's involvement in World War I, which began in 1914 and ended in 1918 with a ceasefire taking effect on November the 11th at 11 in the morning. November being the 11th month, this means 11, 11, 11, totaling 33, as in 33-degree Masons. So the first sunspot cycle averages around 11 years, perhaps due to the roughly 11-year orbit of Jupiter, but varies perhaps due to the orbits of the other planets. 3 times 11 is 33. And most people counting the cervix, neck vertebrae, and the fused vertebrae of the sacrum at the base of the spine have 33 vertebrae. Mystics like the Masons believe that a mysterious energy, sometimes called Kundalini, can be induced to rise up the spine to the head, bringing enlightenment. But Christians and some Buddhist mystics have warned of a false or partial enlightenment that moves people, not closer to God, but in the opposite direction. If 1913 is the true first year of a century, the midpoint is 1963, when they killed JFK, supposedly, and they shot him in Dallas within less than a degree of the 33 parallel on November 22nd, 11 and 22, total 33. Many strange things happen within less than a degree of the 33 parallel. For example, Dallas is Stephensville, Texas, where dozens of people reported seeing a massive UFO. Furthermore, west is the Roswell Corona site, huh? Where a UFO allegedly crashed in 1947. Yet further west is Holloman Air Force Base, rumored to be the landing site of at least one UFO. But still, near the parallel is White Sands Missile Range, where America's space program was begun, largely by Nazi scientists, and where the only launch pad is called Number 33. North of Holloman, but still less than a degree from the 33 parallel, is in Trinity, the nuclear site, where the first atomic bomb was tested, a tricky plutonium implosive bomb. Note that Dallas is on the Trinity River. Further west, the parallel crosses near Arizona's mysterious Superstition Mountains and then Phoenix, named after the mythical bird, which is considered by the Masons to be a symbol of death and rebirth. And in Phoenix, thousands of people in one night reported seeing a massive UFO. The parallel passes near Blythe, California, where there is a massive pre-Columbian Jupa, and finally near Nagasaki, Japan, where the second atomic bomb was dropped. Hiroshima is well away from the 33rd and was destroyed by a relatively simple uranium gun-type bomb. East of Dallas, the 33 passes near ancient Indian ruins at Moundsdale and Poverty Point, and then Charleston, South Carolina, where the first shots of America's Civil War were fired at Fort Sumter. Prior to the Civil War, Charleston was a hotbed of secession sentiment and was headquarters for the southern jurisdiction of Scottish Rite Freemasonry in North America. The line goes by Bermuda and then crosses the Syrian Dead Sea geographical rift zone near Mount Hermon, where the Elohim are said to have descended to mate with human women and produce the Nephil. It crosses the Persian Gulf rift zone near ancient magical Babylon, where the U.S. became involved in a senseless war, and then Afghanistan. Then it crosses Tibet, allegedly the location of legendary Shambhala. America's Declaration of Independence was approved by voice vote of the Continent Congress on 7/2/1776 and went to the printers and made public on 7/4/1776 when the delegates began signing it. So this is accepted as America's birthday. Note that 7 is a magical number, and 7 and 4 add up to 11. The ratio of the height of the Great Pyramid in Giza in Europe, in Egypt, is to one of its base sides is 7 to 11. Many of the founding fathers were Freemasons who would have become aware of this. But the first shots of the American Revolution were fired in 1775 on April the 19th at Lexington Green and Concord Bridge in Massachusetts. Alfred Hitler was born in Australia on 4/20/1889. Remember, depending on exact location and time of day, it can be April 19th in the U.S. while it is already April 20 in Austria. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of all this stuff all ties in. So are they running it by the calendar that we see? Or are they running it by some other calendar is the question, right? So I don't know. I think this is all. And why was Barack Hussein Obama, right? And all that sketchy stuff about his name. They say that it's an American name, it's a blessed name, it's a heroic as American in its own way, as the name of General Omar Nelson Bradley. So yeah, they've named all these things after these deities, right? Barack and Hussein are Semitic words. Americans have been named with Semitic names since the founding of the Republic. 14 of the 43 presidents have had Semitic names. And American English contains many Arabic-derived words that we use every day and without which we would be much impoverished. Barak is a Semitic word meaning to bless, as a verb or blessing as a noun. In its Hebrew form, Barak, it is found all through the Bible. It first occurs in Genesis 1:22. And God blessed them, saying, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the sea, and let fowl multiply in the earth." Barak appeared a whole bunch of times in the Bible. Now let's take the name Hussein. It is from the Semitic word Hassan, H-A-S-A-N, meaning good or handsome. Barak's middle name is in honor of his grandfather Hussein, supposedly from Kenya. Americans may think of Saddam Hussein when they hear the name, but that is like thinking of Stalin when you hear the name Joseph. There have been lots of Husseins in history, but yeah, I think that this Hussein named Obama is one to pay attention to. And they also say that Obama is a cousin of Dick Cheney. So, yeah, I think they all, which brings me to Omar Bradley. So, yeah, all of these names, even the war machines are named with these names, right? What about other American heroes? I looked up just one of them. Hold on a second. This guy named General George Jolon, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. That's Joulwan. That is an Arabic name. Or there is General John Abziba, former CENTCOM commander. Abziba is an Arabic name. So yeah, if you look at their names, I'll make sure and publish that name guide that I found. Let's take another look, another one. Benjamin Franklin. His first name is from Hebrew, Ben, B-I-N, Yamin, Y-A-M-I-N, the son of the right hand, or the son of strength, or the son of the south. The Ben, B-I-N, means son of, just as in modern colloquial Arabic. Ben Yamin Franklin. So yeah, it's a Semitic name. John Abram really only had Semitic names. His first name is from the Hebrew. Yeah. I think the connections are all there. And I think that they've been really working on everybody's brains to dummy everybody out. So they say that Obama, what you're going to read when things come up as a challenge to what they're saying. I think I'm about done here. I have other things that I'll be talking about later, but for right now, I think we get the picture, right? We seem to have people in the Middle East that are all named by specific gods, ISIS and all that stuff. We've got people in charge with Semitic names. Seems pretty clear to me that this was all part of their plan, right? And I guess they're going along with a plan, even though these people aren't specifically the ones from Israel, right? I think they tripped themselves up with those DNA kits, but really it doesn't matter, because if you try to talk to most people about this, they will just write you off as crazy. Even if you show them the facts, you will be considered the craziest person they've ever talked to. But just remember this, crazy is only one step above genius. So be safe out there. I'm getting pretty tired, so I'm going to close this off. I'm trying to scroll down here to make sure I didn't lose anything, but I think I got it all. And I'll be back in an hour or so with the links you're going to want to take a look at. So be safe out there. Goodbye for now, and try to have a good day. And remember, keep those eyes on a swivel. Keep looking around. What's coming ahead? You really need to seriously consider those walkie-talkies. So goodbye for now, and be safe out there.